Okay, good morning, everyone. So my name is Jonathan Ziering. I'm one of the Rebbeim here. So I want to give a bit of a different type of a shiur than Rai Ginsburg gave. One of the things that fascinates me is that in Israeli culture, Israeli society, even when we're talking about people who are not per se religious, especially some of the early leaders, their intuitions were at their core very much Torah intuitions. And therefore, you know, you have sort of this outside criticism from non- or anti-Zionists that, you know, how can you view Israel as part of the Geulah, part of the redemption, if it was founded on purely secular ideals? So there are some, like Rav Kook, who answer this challenge with this idea of a divine chess game, right? That, yes, the founders of Israel were secular, but they didn't realize that they were pawns in God's game, right? In God's divine chess game. And so, in fact, it's religious. They didn't realize that it was religious, but it was, right? Trust me, don't ask me how, right? But God plays his games and he has whatever pawns, and if that pawn is named Ben-Gurion or Weizmann, whoever that pawn is, right, it is part of the divine game. But I come from a different tradition. My late teacher, Avraham Lichtenstein, whose yahrzeit is today, fourth yahrzeit. My 4-year-old is named for him, so I know, my 4-year-old. So 4 years ago. So Rav Lichtenstein had a different view. Rav Lichtenstein was once asked about Cook's view of secular Zionists, right, that they were pawns in God's game, and he said, with all due respect to Rav Kook, I find it patronizing. I mean, if someone came to you and said, look, you know, I know you think you know what you're doing in life, but what you're really doing is beyond you, right? You're just, you know, you're a tool in the divine game. You don't realize that you think you're doing X and you're doing Y, right? None of us would be so comfortable with that. We like to feel like we are who we are. We do what we do. We believe what we believe. And especially if we're idealists and we devote our lives to a cause, we don't want someone to come and say, you think you're devoted to cause X and you're devoted to cause Y. What he suggested instead was recognizing that just because someone doesn't share all of your ideals, that doesn't mean that the ideals that you do share, or the ideals they do hold, aren't at some core level the same overlapping ideals as yours, and there's a synergistic relationship between you and them, even if you don't see the world exactly the same way, right? We can value that which other people do without agreeing with them, even on certain fundamental things. And one of the things I like doing is looking at these early leaders, these early Zionist leaders, and seeing how even if they didn't articulate all of their values in religious language, at core, as religious Zionists, we can identify with their mission. We can identify with their vision, not just because we have a bifurcated self, that we're religious and Zionist, and we can identify with their Zionism, even though we have an added level of religion on top of that, but that we can recognize that within the vision of secular Zionism, there was a core of Torah, even if they didn't always express it the way we might do. So what I want to do is sort of take a case study and examine two personalities. In this case, it's not just, you know, me taking two personalities out of a hat and saying, you know, what shared ideals do these two people have, but taking two personalities who actually interacted with each other, one religious, one secular, but they worked together well specifically because, despite the fact that one spoke in religious language and the other very poignantly did not, their vision for what Israel needed to be and for what they were going to build together was in fact in many ways identical. And those two personalities are Rav Goren, Shlomo Goren, who I know several people thought he was Castro, but it's not. This is Rav Shlomo Goren. and Ben-Gurion. The title Shlomo and David, Rav Goren and Ben-Gurion, is from an article at the end. I don't know if has anyone read the autobiography of Rav Goren? It's excellently done. It was published in English 2 years ago with Might and Strength, like a greenish book, worth reading. It was put out by Goren. Excellent read. Goren is a fascinating personality. He was born to a Hasidish family. His family made Aliyah. They had a Hasidish collective up in the north. You know, he tells his story of, you know, growing up and, you know, getting rid of the swamps and catching malaria every other week. You know, things like that. Interesting, interesting life. But what I want to do is sort of look at some of Rav Goren's life and Ben-Gurion's life and see how in many ways, despite the fact, again, that Rav Goren clearly, he at some point was the chief rabbi of the military, of the IDF, and later became chief rabbi of the country, was clearly a religious personality, right? He checks off all the boxes, right? He was a rabbi, a massive Talmid Chacham, he was even Hasidish, right? He, you know, checks off all the boxes. He has all the credentials. And Ben-Gurion, who very pointedly did not, right? Ben-Gurion, who was very proud to have left religious Judaism for secular Judaism, still shared ideals that were at their core Torah values. So to start off and give sort of a light example, I happen to have an obsession with Ben-Gurion. I think he's fascinating. You'll see his biography, if you read it, is just... He was an interesting person, right? One of my favorite stories, not related to this, was he said he once, someone came to him once and said he had a dream. He had a dream that he had to make a shofar and bring it to Rav Goren so that Rav Goren could blow the shofar on Har Sinai. That was the dream he had. And Rav Goren took this very seriously. So in the middle of, I think this was the war with Egypt in 56... He had this shofar from this guy. The guy actually brought the shofar with him. He illegally drove up to the mountain that he believed was Har Sinai, Jebel Musa, right, and went to the top to blow the shofar. And then he went back several years later to do it again. Right, Rav Goren was an interesting person. So the first time he met Ben-Gurion, and this I think will sort of frame the whole shir, he had been suggested to be the rabbi of the IDF before there was an IDF. Right, it was before the state had actually been founded, right before, so 47, by Rav Herzog, who was the chief rabbi of the Mandate, and then became the chief rabbi of Israel. So he goes to Ben-Gurion, and he has a very productive meeting with Ben-Gurion. They get along, they see the world together, but Rav Goren was not born Shlomo Goren. His name when he was born was, being European, Shlomo Goranchik. So he walks in, and he has this productive meeting, but as he's leaving, he said, Ben-Gurion turned to him and he said, by the way, drop the chick, you're Goren. And he said, I walked into the meeting, Rav Shlomo Goranchik, and I walked out, Rav Shlomo Goren. Right, that was the way Ben-Gurion worked. Now, where did that come from? Right, because it's a funny story, it's a comical moment, but it actually captures a lot of the way Ben-Gurion, and as we'll see, Rav Goren, viewed Israel. Why was it that Ben-Gurion told him to do that? So if you know anything about Israeli history, the early Zionists were very into this. They very much felt that part of coming to a new country was Israelifying your name, right? Hebraicizing your name. Right, was to change the very way that our name sounded as we entered a new era. Right, Ben-Gurion was not born Ben-Gurion, he was born
Green.
Right? And Ben-Gurion therefore very much encouraged people to change their name, even their last name, to be more Israeli. Hence, Goranchik to Goren. But is there anything in Torah that might indicate that he was on to something, that part of coming back to Israel might actually express itself in something as seemingly mundane as your name? So if we look at some of the sources, the first source here is a quite well-known source. It's a Midrash in Vayikra Rabbah. I can look at it in English, but versions of this Midrash are quite well-known. Rav Huna stated in the name of Bar Kappara, Israel, were redeemed from Egypt on account of four things. Because they did not change their names, they did not change their language, they did not go tail-bearing, and none of them was found to have been immoral. The Midrash is grappling in what merit did the Jews, who didn't yet have a Torah, as far as we know were idolaters, right? As is accounted for in Yoshua and Yechezkel, right? The Jews in Egypt were idolaters. Right? In what merit did they deserve to leave Egypt? So the Midrash outlined several possibilities, one of which was they didn't change their name. They maintained Jewish names. On a more mystical level, the source of number two, the Gemara in Brachot tells you that it's not just that a name is a cultural marker, it actually affects your, or reflects your spiritual essence. Right? So from where do we derive that the name affects one's life? Rabbi Eliezer said that the verse says, go see the works of the Lord who have made this desolation, Shamot, and then they play on that. Do not read the word as Shamot, rather as Shemot. So the name, the Gemara has this claim that names actually, they don't just sort of act as cultural markers, but they actually reflect or capture a spiritual essence. Similarly, in the Gemara number 3, Rabbi Meir used to say that this is true on the negative. That if you meet someone with a name that sounds negative, I don't know, come up with a name. I don't know, Lucifer, I don't know. Come up with a name, right? You should be suspect of, right? You should be suspect of that person because if a name reflects their essence, so then you should avoid people whose names lead you to believe that they are suspicious individuals. Now this has halachic implications. In number 4, I gave you just the translation, but I'll say it outside. Maram Shik, one of the leading students of the Chasam Sofer, wrote that it is a biblical prohibition to use a non-Jewish name. Right? He took this so far as to say that why is it that one should use a Jewish name? Why did the Midrash praise the Jews for maintaining Jewish names? What halachic value is there? So he said, well, there's a prohibition which we mentioned in last week's parsha, at least in Israel we did, of Bichukoteim lo teilechu, do not follow the ways of the nations around you. And the Maram Shik said, one of those ways that you follow the nations is by taking a name like, whatever, Peter, yeah, Lucifer from Morningstar, sure, right? And the Maram Shik therefore argued that if you take and use a non-Jewish name, that's actually a biblical prohibition. Right, of Bichukoteim lo teilechu, don't follow the ways of the nations. Now, other poskim disagreed with sort of this radical formulation. Right, Ramosha Feinstein, we'll do a lot of these sort of outside. Ramosha Feinstein, the next source, argued that maybe that's not true. Maybe only in an era without Torah. Right, I mean, when you have Torah, what makes us Jewish is that we identify with the system of the Torah. But in Egypt, they didn't yet have the Torah. So without Torah, what made people Jewish? Culture. Society. And therefore, in Egypt, sure, it was important to have a Jewish name. But, you know, once you have the Torah, if you're a good from Jew, just for some bizarre reason, your parents named you Lucifer, whatever. Right? There are stories like this, right? Rav Kook had someone, not Lucifer, but whose father had been a... This is one of those apocryphal stories, which I don't know if it's true. If it's true, it's good. If not, then whoever made up the story was smart. But that someone approached Rav Kook, and you know his father had been a frum Jew, and he had rebelled and become secular, and to just sort of stick it to his parents, he named his son Korach. Right? He named his son Korach. Or Korach Nimrod, I think it was. He like picked like two sort of biblical rebellious names, and he went to Rav Kook just to elicit a reaction. Again, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard this from Rav Kook. But he went to Rav Kook and he said, "You know, what do you think? I named my son Korach and Nimrod." And he said to him, "Look, if your father had named you Korach, I'd be upset because your father was a good Jew, and it would have been bad if you rebelled against him. You're horrible. If your kids rebel against you, it's fine with me, right?" So, but, you know, there are, so Moshe Feinstein argues, he says, look, you know, if you had someone, you have this Rivkook's Korach, who rebels against his father and goes back to Torah Judaism. You know, he keeps 613 mitzvot, but he keeps Korach to remember this story, right? He still goes by Korach to remember this story. You know, it's good at, like, you know, it's good at parties, right? Why are you named Korach, you know? So that's not a violation. But even Moshe argues that obviously that doesn't mean that it's not valuable, right? Using a Jewish name may not be a formal obligation, but it's clearly valuable, right? Rav Asher Weiss argues, yeah, it's a midat chasidut. It's a, you know, it's a good thing to do. Now, the Avnei Yashveh argues, well, maybe it depends what type of name you have, right? You know, if you have a name like mine, Jonathan, okay, so Jonathan is just a translation of a Hebrew name. So that's Jewish enough, right? So maybe that's fine, right? As opposed to a name that has no Hebrew equivalent, maybe there's a difference. But whether you think it's a formal obligation or not, there's clearly a value to marking yourself with a Jewish name. Now, Ben-Gurion took it a little bit farther, right, and argued, essentially, even though he didn't put it in his language, that if a name reflects your identity, and having a Jewish name reflects your Jewishness, then having a name that came from Europe, which was imposed on us by the outside, is, even if it's a Jewish name, Green, that's still, at its core, not Jewish. Because how did we get last names to begin with? Well, it depends if you were rich, if you were poor. But the point is, it was imposed from the outside, right? It was imposed by the outside. You had to take family names. And if you were lucky, you got a name like Green. If you weren't lucky, you got a name that was negative. Right? If you were lucky, you got one that was a color. You got one that was your profession. Right, if you were rich, maybe you got a nice name. If you were poor, you know, you didn't get such a good name. Certain poskim were very angry about this. The Ram Shik, we mentioned before, right, why was he named Shik? Because he thought it was prohibited to take a last name at all. Right? Because the entire notion of a family name was a secular construct. Right? Jews were always named, you know, Avram, Ben, whatever. So why did he take the name Shik? Because Shik is an acronym for Shem Yisrael Kodesh, right? Jewish names are holy, right? It was a passive, right? Passive-aggressive, right? Last name to protest the notion of taking last names. So Ben-Gurion wasn't actually wrong, right? Last names may have no halachic status, but it was true that the construct of a last name was imposed from the outside, and the names that were given to us were markers of the fact that we were in Galut. And therefore, he felt that you should change your last name as you enter into a new era. And the history of this is fascinating. I gave you just from Wikipedia number 9. It's a very long Wikipedia entry, because this was actually a lot of fascinating history here. They write, right, the Hebraization of names, of surnames, or Ivrut in Hebrew, is the act of adopting a Hebrew surname in exchange for their diaspora names. For many diaspora Jews who migrated to the land of Israel, taking a Hebrew surname was a way to erase remnants of their diaspora experience and to assimilate into a new shared identity as Palestinian Jews or Jewish residents of Ottoman Palestine and Mandatory Palestine, and later as Israeli Jews. This phenomenon was especially common amongst Ashkenazi Jews because many such families only acquired permanent surnames rather than patronyms when surnames were made compulsory by the November 12, 1787 decree by the Habsburg Emperor Joseph II. Now, if you skip to number 10, and I'll say this a bit outside, this was part of a process known as Shlilat HaGolah, right? The attempt of those who returned to Israel to negate the diasporic experience. But Ben-Gurion was so obsessed with this that he actually put out a booklet, a Jewish agency booklet, giving people suggestions of how they should change their names. And at some point, he issued an order to all commanding officers in the IDF that they had to change their name to a more Israeli name. Right? He was obsessed with this notion. Now, there were some who were very opposed. Right? There were some who were very opposed. If you turn to the next page, right? You skip to 12 for a moment. This is from Moshe Calvary in his book, In Between Sowing and Harvest, also from Wikipedia. Right? Yitzchak ben Tzvi demands all that we disqualify all the foreign names which are close to us. His assumption was that our immigration to Eretz Israel is a revolutionary act, a return to one's origins. Let the memory of the diaspora therefore be erased, that the crown be returned to ancient times, by wrapping our names in the envelope of our language. I have my doubts if this zealousness is appropriate. Our names are part, a significant part of our history. Bearers of historical names are still alive and among us. The names of figures who mark our history, names like Sesportas or Benavisti, Abarbanel or Dan Yechia, Rappaport or Eibschitz, there's no reason to delete the chronicle of our national life. Let us preserve the faith of our fathers also in our revival. Do not betray our memories by radical action, and the text does not only relate to the famous, etc. So there were those who opposed and said, no, to be Israeli doesn't mean to pretend that we aren't Olim from the diaspora, right? Meaning, if you have a Green who's prime minister, doesn't that make as much of a statement than having a Ben-Gurion? But this was not Ben-Gurion's personal intuition. He thought, no, we have to mark our Aliyah by new names. But, as I said, there is something there which is fundamentally Torah true. And therefore, there were poskim who agreed with him. So to take an example that's close to my heart, my late Rosh Yeshiva, not Rav Lichtenstein, but my other Rosh Yeshiva, Yehuda Amital, the two founding Rosh Yeshivas of Yeshiva Har Tzion, and the namesakes of my child, both of them, Aaron Yehuda. He was born Yehuda Klein. And he made Aliyah after the Holocaust and changed his name to Rav Yehuda Amital. Why Amital? Because the Pasuk, he took it from the Pasuk. In Hosea, that Vahaya She'irit Yaakov, Bekerav Amim Rabim, Kital Me'et Hashem, Girvim Alei Esev. Right, that we will be like, that the remnant of Yaakov will be in the midst of people like dew from God. My nation will be like dew. Right, we'll... You know, sort of that dew that you wake up and it's a new morning. Right? So he felt that he had to leave his identity as Klein behind, having gone through Auschwitz, and he needed to come to Israel as Amital, as the beginning of something new. Rav Shlomo Aviner, who is a current leading rabbi in the religious Zionist community, was not at all born Shlomo Aviner. Does anyone have his actual birth name? A little bit less Jewish. Smith. Claude Langenauer. Okay? You know. Similar, right? It's a good from name. Claude Langenauer. From France, Rav Aviner changed his name to Shlomo Aviner, as we know him now. And he argued why. So if you look at the next piece and look at the translations, my translation, but hopefully it's good. He writes, regarding Hebraicizing a family name, is this something that is merely permitted, or is it proper, needed, and important as part of the return to Israel, and the separation from the exile, and the like? Should this be done even if the other brothers will not change their family name? And is it permitted to do this if his parents oppose? Right, meaning, right, should we change our names? What if you're going to be the only one in your family who changes the name, so now your brothers don't have the same name as you, right? His brother is still Langenauer? I don't know if that's true. Let's assume that that is. And what if your parents don't want it? So he writes, there's a benefit to Hebraicizing names so that we'll have Jewish names. The words of the Maram Shik, that one who uses a non-Jewish name violates a biblical prohibition of following their customs, as it says, I shall separate for you from the nations to be mine, from which we derive that it is not permitted to imitate them in any way. However, there's room to question his position, distinguish between cases where he does this explicitly to imitate them. For other reasons, he said, look, I can argue that it's not technically obligatory, that it's not prohibited to use non-Jewish names. But still, if you skip down, he says, but what emerges is that there's certainly a value to a Jewish name. And therefore, at the end, he argues that you should do it, it's a good deed, even if your parents don't want it, even if your family won't do it. Right? This is, in fact, an expression of the Maram Shik's obligation of B'chukosem lo seilechu. Right? Again, even if it's not formally obligated, it's a good thing to do. So this story, that short story we started with, of Rav Goren going in as Goronchik and leaving as Goren, right? It's a funny story. It's a light story, but at some level you see that it actually reflects, right? Why did Rav Gordon get along so well with Ben-Gurion? Because point number one was that they both recognized that Israel was a new era, and this was something that Rav Gordon understood from a halachic perspective, and I think Ben-Gurion from a sort of intuitive political perspective. Social markers are actually important. And social markers are important, right? We can pretend they're not, but they are. Right? A name means something. And to mark in a change in era, a change in historical period, with a change in name, with actually is a powerful expression of culture. And as Rav Gordon, if Rav Avinair sort of captures his position, right, recognizes it's an expression of halachic values as well. I'm not saying that this is the only way to read the sugya, but I'm saying that the voice Ben-Gurion had from a social Zionist perspective, right, Rav Gordon, Rav Avinair, and others, right, felt the same way from halachic tradition. Nachum, you had a question? Okay. Second point, and this is a story that I think is excellent. If we only get to these two points, then Dayenu. This is a fascinating story in Rav Gordon's life. Has anyone ever heard of the disaster of the Shtei HaTabachim? Okay. The two cooks. The incident of the two cooks. So, this is discussed in Rav Gordon's biography, autobiography. So, the day was July 31st, 1948. 33rd Battalion of the Alexandri Brigade, two cooks who were Dati, were Shomrei Shabbat. Their general says to them, cook. And they said, no, we're not going to cook because it's Shabbos. They were convicted for insubordination, sent to military prison for a week. When they appealed the decision, it was extended to 3 months. And then in what was perhaps a really bad political PR move, the general had their heads and beard shaven, including the payout. Right? In 1948, right after the Holocaust, this was a really bad political move. But there were a lot of religious secular tensions at the time, and their commander was quite upset that they were allowing religion to influence how they served in the army. The fallout was, predictably, really bad. Rav Maimon, not the Rambam, Rav Maimon was the Sar HaDatot. He was the religious affairs minister. He resigned. Right? He resigned in protest and said, such an army does not deserve to be a Jewish army. There were protests in Bnei Brak, Ramat Gan, Tel Aviv. And it led to a statement by Staff Major General Yaakov Dori that a military rabbinate would be created, which would deal with these issues, the first chief rabbi of the army being Rav Gordon. Thank you. That was a giveaway question there. Yeah, Rav Gordon. Okay. Now what happened? A meeting was called to figure out how they were going to deal with this question. And there was basically two views in the room. The view of everybody versus Rav Gordon. Okay? Everybody in the room, religious and secular, said, you know what the solution is? How are we going to coexist as religious and secular Jews in the army? What's the solution? Separate. Separate. Right? That was everyone's solution. Right? And people were quite articulate about how they felt. So secular, Aaron Sisling of Mapam. This is Rav Gordon's memory of this. He was ready to put all the religious soldiers in separate companies, platoons, battalions, divisions, to give them everything they wanted, let them pray all day, every day, all week long, to let them eat chulent, all week long, and do whatever they wanted, on the condition that they let the non-religious soldiers do whatever they want. Right? That was the secular position, right? It was derisive, patronizing, but it was like, look, you leave us alone, I don't care what you do, right? I love that, like, image, right? Daven all day, eat chulent all day, wear tefillin, right? Do it. That's your, you want that to count as your military service? I don't care, but leave us alone. The religious parties said, fine with us. Right? You do your thing, we'll do ours, we'll have our minyanim, we'll have kashrut, you do whatever you want. So everyone was in agreement, right? The religious party said, let's separate. The secular party said, let's separate. Everyone said, we'll go our merry way, except Rav Gorin. Rav Gorin comes in and he yells at them. He turns to the religious parties and he says, right, look at the end here, what's bolded. He said, what would be the ramifications... What would the ramifications be of the religious soldiers being segregated in religious units? The result would be that the entire army wouldn't observe religious precepts, wouldn't eat kosher food, wouldn't observe Shabbat and holidays, wouldn't have any synagogues. He said, what exactly are you doing? By agreeing to separate, what you're really signing on to is that the non-religious units in the army will not know what Shabbos, not keep kashrus, not do anything. It's easier for you, but what is the cost to the Jewish flavor, identity of the emerging army? It's going to be secular. There's going to be no Torah in it whatsoever. He said only the few special units that would be defined as religious would have strictly kosher food, observe all the Shabbat laws, and have synagogues. Now that we have won the right to establish our own state, now that we build the IDF, we had the right to demand the entire army behave like a Jewish army. And he turned to them and he said, are you out of your minds? Right, we've fought for 2,000 years to get a state, and now, what's your idea of a state? That there'll be a few religious units? You can do that in the American army also, right? Every year when in Wayusmicha, they have two chaplains come from the American army. You can have from Orthodox Jews in the American army. They'll get you kosher food, right? They give us all the pictures of them going to Tovel Kalim in Fallujah in tanks, right? It'll be fun. It'll make for good stories. But that's what you want the IDF to be, right? A few religious people in the army, in their own units, and everybody else, right? Torah, forget about it. So are you crazy? For this we fought? For this we're religious Zionists? For this we believe that we've started a religious process of Gula? So, how is it that our army is not bifurcated if it was everyone against Rav Gorin? So the answer was, it wasn't everyone against Rav Gorin. It started as everyone against Rav Gorin, and then an ally came into the room who agreed with Rav Gorin, who was Ben-Gurion. Right? Ben-Gurion came in, and as Ben-Gurion was wont to do, in one line, said, Yesh lanu am echad, tzava echad, medina echad, v'lo yitached lefatzel et tzava lefi hashkafot. One nation, one army, one state. We cannot split the army based on outlook. Period, end of story, and the rest is history. And Ben-Gurion and Rav Gorin agreed on something very fundamental. Right? All the religious and secular people at that meeting thought that it was a plausible vision for a modern state of Israel to have completely bifurcated religious and secular elements of society. And Rav Gorin and Ben-Gurion recognized that as hard as it was going to be to bridge the gap between religious and secular Jews in Israeli society, it was worth the cost because it's not a Jewish state if it's not a singular Jewish state. Ben-Gurion was willing to put his money where his mouth was, right? So now some of Ben-Gurion's most infamous decisions, right? People now look at some of his decisions as quite negative because of the fights that they have caused. But you have to understand where he's coming from, right? He signed the status quo, what has become known as the status quo letter, right? What was the status quo letter? Right? Ben-Gurion, at the beginning, in order to get Haredi quasi-support for the state, agreed that kashrut would be left under the auspices of the Rabbanut, marriage would be left under the auspices of Rabbanut, there would be Shabbat laws in the country, right? And now people scream and yell about it, right? But why did he do it? Right? He did it because he believed that it was worth the cost to the secular if we could forge a state together. Because as much as he had left religion, he recognized that a fundamental core tenet in Judaism is Achdut. And it can't be a Jewish state if we totally bifurcate and divide. And Rav Gorin agreed. And therefore they got along together because they were sort of outliers who were willing to say, no, to build a Jewish state means to build it together, even if that means we fight. And I like to point this out sometimes. Right? People get all annoyed. We're fighting. Why don't we just let people do whatever they want? Fighting is evidence of the fact that we're in the project together. Right? Imagine it, right? If you're at a Seder, let's say, with a bunch of friends, right? And everybody says, oh, you know, in my house growing up, we sang whatever, I don't know, Dayenu to this tune, right? Does anyone fight about that? No, they all say, oh, that's so interesting what you did in your house, right? This is what we did in our house. Maybe we'll sing both. Maybe we'll choose one. But let's say you have two siblings at the Seder, and one says, this is the tune we always sang. And the other one said, that was the tune we always sang. Then they fight. Why? Because they have a shared history, and they're arguing over their shared history. Right? You only fight if you're in the same game. Right? Because you're trying to take ownership of it. Right? And Rav Goren and Ben Gurion were saying, look, we're willing to take the difficulties that's going to come with not bifurcating because we believed that to have a Jewish state is to be in it together, and if that causes a bit of agony, so it causes a bit of agony, but at least we're fighting about it because we are both part of this project together. Which gives me a little bit of comfort when you see all the fighting in the Knesset, right? It's like, yeah, we fight because we care, because we're in this together, right? And sometimes you'd wish, you know, I spent the last 3 years in Canada, right? Sometimes you wish that everything was like in Canada, right? You know, they had like a 2 week, you know, for 2 weeks, the news, all it could talk about was Justin Trudeau accidentally elbowed somebody on his way up to speak from the floor of Parliament and didn't apologize with enough perceived sincerity. Right? This was like the scandal for 2 weeks. Sometimes you wish that Israel was Canada. But on the other hand, in Canada, right, Canada is known for being totally apathetic politically. Because like, okay, we live here, but we're not invested in it. Right? When people fight about it, it's because at least we're in this together and we fight about it because we care. So that's how Ben-Gurion was willing to compromise. What about Rav Goren? Right? In what way did Rav Goren's conviction that you needed a joint state express itself? Because right, Ben-Gurion could bring politics to the table. Rav Goren was a post-it. What did he bring to the table? So Rav Goren, and Ben-Gurion in a YouTube video I put here, says that this is what he liked about Rav Goren so much. Rav Goren felt, well, look, if I believe the state has to function with secular Jews and religious Jews together, that means that I can't rely on secular Jews to be my Shabbos goy. Which means that I need to find halachic solutions that are creative, that allow us to build a state and a health system that will maximize keeping Shabbat. Right? Meaning, if I believe that we can't bifurcate the nation, that means I also can't act as if there's a million Shabbos goys around who can do my dirty work. Instead, as a post-ig, I need to explain how, even if everyone became religious, we could have this state. And therefore, Rav Goren said, if I believe this, right, Ben-Gurion will bring politics, and he'll compromise religious parties. But I will express my conviction in unity through halachic creativity. And if you look at number 20, just look at the italicized part. This is in Rav Goren's reason for permitting medical autopsies in Israel to allow for medical schools. He writes, it is inconceivable the Jewish state would base its health system, which is vital for the nation and the state, on Gentile corpses. It is inconceivable that we cannot find a halachic way to maintain a high level of modern medicine by conducting autopsies on corpses of our own as is done throughout the world. And the next quote from a lecture he gave with Ben-Gurion present in 1966, it is clear that we need Torah leaders who will have a nationalistic approach to political questions and a positive approach to the historical turn of the Jewish people that happened with the establishment of the state. The eternity of the Torah lies in the space for maneuvering that the possibilities open to its guardians, scholars, and those who fulfill it. There's an expression in the Talmud Yerushalmi. If the Torah had been given clear cut, it would not have a leg to stand on. So the Torah could be expounded in 49 ways to render something impure and 49 ways to render it pure. In other words, if the Torah was given as a fixed code, do this and don't do that, it would not have been possible to stand on our feet and live according to it. Rather, it was given in a flexible way, with 49 ways to render something impure, and 49 ways to render it pure, 49 ways to obligate, 49 ways to exonerate. Each generation has its own innovations in Torah, but all this is only within the framework of the Torah, with the framework of Halacha. And Ben-Gurion was present at that speech. Right, Rav Goren and Ben-Gurion got along because Ben-Gurion said, look, I'm the politician, I'm willing to compromise on my politics if it means we'll have unity. And Rav Goren said, I'm a posek. And I think halacha, I wouldn't say compromise, that's the word Ben-Gurion used, right? Not the word Rav Goren used, but I will find the halachic flexibility to make this work. The third thing, very quickly, was that both of them believed that because Jews had been in Galut for so long, if we wanted to find a model upon which to base modern Israel, part of it had to come from Tanakh. And therefore, as secular as he was, Ben-Gurion wrote Svarim on Tanakh. We have his commentaries on Tanakh. You can look them up. They're not just, they are actually quite creative. Right? He had weekly sessions of Tanakh learning in his office, right? He was committed to this. He meant it. Right? He may not have fully believed in, Torah Judaism as we do, but he thought that Torah, especially Tanakh, could give us a vision that had been lost for a long time of what it meant to create a Jewish state. And Rav Goren, from his perspective as a posek, was unique in taking as primary sources not only, Shulchan Aruch and the Gemara, but stories in Tanakh. And in that had not been used for legal text. Probably the most famous one was his argument that it was permitted to commit suicide for a soldier who was going to be captured by enemy combatants rather than be captured and humiliated and cause all that would come from it. And his source was Shaul and Masada, right? Was Shaul and Masada, right? Was that, look, the last time we had our own state, King Shaul, when he was attacked and he was dying, rather than let himself be captured, he committed suicide and fell on his sword. And therefore you see that as an independent Jewish polity, sometimes national respect and glory allows you to do things under normal circumstances would be prohibited. So I think these three examples show you the type of way, about religious Zionism. Is that, instead of, in the Rav Kook model, looking at secular Zionism as just a pawn in God's plan, right? I try to see the ways in which the founding fathers of Israel, even the secular ones, how their project was in many ways reflective of Torah values, right? Number one, right? Rav Goren and Ben Gurion's conviction that the state of Israel was a unique stage in Jewish history and needed to be marked by symbolism, by name change, by culture, because culture is meaningful. And Halacha recognized that to be Jewish is not just to keep Torah, but is to have a Jewish name, to have a Jewish culture, to have Jewish markers and symbols. Two, was their conviction that to have a Jewish state is to recognize that Achdut is a fundamental value, even if that means taking political compromises for Ben-Gurion, and even if that means being creative in Halacha to make it work, which is Rav Goren's contribution to the conversation. And number three was their belief that to create a Jewish polity is to learn lessons from Tanakh, a source that had been mostly silent as a normative source in our years in Galut. And therefore, even as a secular Jew, Ben-Gurion looked at it for inspiration, and as a posek, Rav Goren was willing to go out and take controversial positions in his belief that without going back to sources that had not been used independently in thousands of years, you couldn't craft a halacha that legitimately captured the modern moment. And therefore you see, again, you can disagree with any of these claims, but my point is more to present a model, a way of thinking through these issues, and to recognize that instead of just saying, we're religious Zionists and secular Zionism is just a pawn in that, is to recognize that maybe they articulated their values differently, but many of the leaders of and the values that led secular Zionism at the beginning of the state, at their core, if you dig a little bit deeper, are expressions of Torah values, and therefore we can value them on their own terms, even if we couch it in different language. And I think that gives religious Zionists a ways of reclaiming the tradition of secular Zionism and feeling more like it's our story, not just a story that we participate in from the sidelines, but one that we see at its core as an expression of values that we also share, even if we believe that we should add the Torah more explicitly to the conversation. That doesn't mean that we can't see the Torah values that are latent in the decisions that brought us to where we are. So with that...